For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Let's get back into our study. Last week, we began our study of the book of 1 Samuel, and we're going to continue that this morning, focusing in on David, that we're calling here in this series the heart of a leader. And we're calling it that for a reason, and which is that of the 73 Psalms that David wrote and the scores written by those in his inner circle, the three historical books that focus on him, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, we see the reference to the heart 150 times. And that recurring theme of the heart, the importance of the heart, leading from the heart, being a kind of person of the heart, this is really characterizes who David is and is the secret for what he was able to accomplish in bringing Israel to the height of their ancient history, of bringing to them peace from all their neighbors and a spiritual revolution of which we are the beneficiaries even here today. So David is a great man, but the greatness of David is his heart, and I take great courage from that because that's the great leveler, isn't it? We all have the same opportunity to make the same impact as a man like David, because we, like David, have those decisions that we can make within our heart to go God's way and to begin to experience the transforming power of his Spirit as he works within us, to have that effect on the world that he calls us to. And so this morning I want to just continue on in that discussion. We're going to move to a very familiar passage in 1 Samuel 17. So if you have your Bible with you, you might want to open it up. And we're going to look at this text that really is summarized by David's expression of his heart in verse 32, where he says, "Let no man's heart fail." And so here's the text. The setting begins in the first verse. It says, "The Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socah, which belongs to Judah, and they encamped between Socah and Azekah in Ephrathdammim. Saul, who was the king, and the men of Israel were camped in the valley of Elah, dressed in battle array to engage the Philistines." And then it says, "The Philistines stood on one mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them." And that is exactly where that happened. That is a Google map of that valley right there. And you can see that the Philistines are really on higher elevation. The Israeli army is on to your left as you look at it. The valley is in between, and they are just looking at each other day after day, and indeed week after week. The Philistines were Israel's greatest threat. The whole book of 1 Samuel up to this point really revolves around the threat of the Philistines. These are the ones who stepped into the power vacuum created in the 1300s BC when the Egyptians no longer had the military ability to control the Middle East. And as a result, these people from the sea settled along the coastline. The Philistines, they had iron, they were warriors. There are five major cities of the Philistines in Palestine. And from them, we know a great deal about the nature of this culture, their religion, the kind of danger that they posed, both in terms of their aggression and their an incredibly debased culture. And so Israel is really is experiencing an existential threat to its own being at this point. And so with that in mind, the story moves forward to the challenge. Very familiar. A champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. That's 9 feet tall. I put in parentheses 4 because the Greek translation of this text, which is called the Septuagint, in 200 BC, has it as 4 cubits and a span, as well as the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are datable to about 120 BC in this scroll, also have the height of Goliath at 4 cubits and a span. That's about 6'4", and which would be massive in comparison to an ancient person whose height would be not a lot more than 5 feet high. It's a significant advantage. But maybe we don't know for sure, but it seems that there's very good manuscript data to really conclude that Goliath was not some 9-foot monster, but rather was an extremely imposing 6'4" warrior. It says he had a bronze helmet on his head. He was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze, 125 pounds. So you get an idea of the stature of this man. He also had a bronze shin guard, carried a bronze javelin. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and its head weighed 600 shekels of iron. His shield carrier also walked before him. He's so laden with the weapons of war that he actually has to have a shield carrier walk in front of him. He stood and he shouted to Israel's army, "Why do you gather for battle? Am I not a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man and let him come down to me. If he is able to kill me, then I will become your servants. But if I prevail, then you shall become our servants." An interesting idea. How few people would die in war if we only resolved our conflicts this way. We read on. Again, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel today. Give me a man who may fight, we may fight together." And when Saul and all Israel heard this, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Think of it, this massive man challenging anyone from Israel to come down, fight him mano a mano with everything at stake. So they are greatly afraid. And in that context, David enters the story. It says in verse 12, "Now David was the son of an Ephratite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse. He had 8 sons and was advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse followed Saul into battle. They were Eliab, the firstborn, Abinadab, and Shema. And David was the youngest. He stayed back to tend his father's sheep. Now, Goliath came forward every day for 40 days to take his stand. Just think of the intimidation. Every single day, this guy's showing up. Meanwhile, Jesse sent to David to deliver for his brothers who were encamped with Saul. So David arose early and he left the flock with a keeper and delivered the supplies to his brothers. And when he arrived, the army was shouting a battle cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up in battle array, army against army. And they're just like, "Bah!" It's kind of a Braveheart moment. They're all yelling at each other and trying to whoop it up. Yet again, after 40 days of doing nothing. And David, it says, left his baggage to the care of the baggage keeper, and he ran to the battle line, and he entered in order to greet his brothers. "Hey, how's it going?" Now, the narrative really focuses then on 4 responses to this crisis that was brought upon Israel by the Philistines. And I want to dissect them a little bit with you here this morning because I think it really does show us the heart of David and exposes things in our own hearts that are not like David. Things that God is very interested in are coming to terms with and aware of so that we can move forward, so that we can be more like the person that David was. And so we're going to look at the armies of Israel. We're going to look at David's older brother. We're going to look at Saul, and we're going to contrast those with Goliath and how David in each of those instances really offers a very different perspective and a different agenda for what does it mean to be a person of God. Let's take a look. First, Israel's fear. It says that at that time, the champion of the Philistines, Goliath, was coming up from his army, and he challenged Israel, and David heard him. So this has been said before, but now David has heard him. And when the men of Israel saw Goliath, they fled in great fear. And they said, "Have you seen this man coming from the Philistines? He is coming to defy Israel." Saul, it says, will reward the one who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter in marriage and will make his father's house tax-free in Israel. Pretty good deal, but it's a kind of a high-risk, high-reward proposition. So we read on. Then David spoke. Okay, we're a chapter and a half into the story of David. David has not said a word. Finally, David speaks. And he says to the men who were standing by him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" And so here we have a change of perspective. And I want to contrast heart failure with a heart of belief. And we're going to see how this works for all four of these scenes that we want to unpack here with you this morning. The heart failure of Israel really demonstrates what fear looks like. That is a kind of a common image of David versus Goliath, isn't it? Not very realistic. A lot of our fears actually are not very realistic. They are more bark than bite. But often as well, many of the things that we do face are painfully realistic and really pose a real threat to us, and that fear ultimately is a very reasonable response. A response to what? A response to the tragedies of life, the difficulties of life. Fear is what it means to be confronted. I was thinking this week about the things that have occupied my thought life, the things that are of concern to me, the people that I'm interacting with. One longtime relationship that I've had for 40 years now has found out this week that he has stage 4 lung cancer. He lives in fear right now. A good friend of mine has a son who has a biochemical brain problem, and he has no ability to control outbursts, and so he's hitting adolescence and he's full of rage and they don't know how to control him and they are afraid for his future. I talked to a friend earlier this week who is lonely, who is wondering, when will that person come into my life that I can share my life with and have that intimacy that I so richly need and feel that I must have to be able to move forward. And she's living in fear. And there are just, for all of us, it would just be absurd for us to say that we don't have fears, because we live in a broken world and we know that how we end it, how where everything goes from here. Fears are reasonable. The question is not, do you have fears? If you say, "I have no fear," I don't think you know yourself very well. The question isn't whether you have them, it's what do you do with them. Fears taunt us. Just like Goliath standing there defying the armies of Israel, our fears say you'll be mastered by this thing that you fear. This thing defines you. This thing will undo you. And so as a result, we live in a state of anxiety, of anger, of constantly wondering what will the future hold. And so for many of us, that our life is really all about trying to control our world so that the things that we fear have a less and less threat in our life. But it's like playing a game of whack-a-mole, where we deal with one problem and then another pops up, and we pound on that and another pops up, and it never ends. I used to think, I was really taxed by having two young children. I thought, I can't wait till they're both in school. It's going to be great. We'll have a normal schedule. Then I thought, well, once they get in high school, they're more independent, then things will be great. And then it just sort of goes on and on. Every stage of life, you continue looking forward, thinking, if it was just this way. And you get there and you realize, man, it's just not at all what I thought it would be. And we live our lives so often just this way. We're thinking in deficit terms. We're thinking about, what are the things that I worry about and which seek to control my life? Our financial security, our relational security, our physical health, all of these things. And so, as for Israel, the rewards of faith seem like a distant pipe dream. You know, this promise that Saul makes, I'll give you my daughter in marriage, your family will be tax-free. And Israel's like, yeah, right, that sounds great, but how unrealistic. And so it is for many of us when we read the pages of Scripture and it talks about a life of peace, a life of joy, a life of real contentment and satisfaction. We wonder, you know, I like the picture, but I don't see that happening in my life. Is that like you? You understand what I'm talking about? It just seems like the things that the Scriptures calls to and describe a healthy spiritual life seem utterly distant to us. And so what we are really confronted by is the power of our fears, which just totally obscure our ability to think in real terms that I could enjoy the things that God freely offers to me in Jesus Christ. That is the problem of fear. That's the threat of fear. And David's perspective is so refreshing. Three times he raises this question in the narrative. What does this fear say about the living God? The Philistines have taunted the armies of the living God. That is the real issue here. It's not whether or not that person poses a real threat. Of course they do, but is that all that we can calculate from? Where is God in the mix? That is the real question that David is going to begin to address. Second response is his brother Eliab. It says, Eliab, the oldest brother, heard David speaking to the men, and his anger burned against David. He said, why have you come here? And who is with the sheep? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart. You've come to see the battle. And David responds, what have I done now? I'm just asking. So you see this typical older brother persecuting younger brother phenomenon, so common to life. What's going on here? Eliab had really taken his fear a step further. Eliab really represents cynicism at this point. There's a heart attitude that we see in Eliab where he is really now, he's looking at the motives of his brother. His brother is just given this trite, superficial, naive retort, you know, oh, Goliath has taunted the armies of the living God. Tell me something I don't know. You know, for him, that was just something that was absurd and meant nothing. And here's the point, and this is an important point. When you obey the counsel of your fears, hopelessness reigns. When you obey the counsel of your fears, you will never get out of the hopelessness, the cynicism that is represented in Eliab's response to his brother. And I want to speak in real direct terms here with you this morning, because I know that many of you live in a state of hopelessness. And where you look at your life and you see the real deficits that are there, and you have surrendered to their mastery, and you've said, this is just the way I am. And we look at our circumstances and say, that's just the way it is. And so now we're just trying to manage. We lowered our expectations to an acceptable low, and we're just going to try to live within the what we can make as a comfortable cocoon for ourselves in the little misery that we endure. And to the extent that you can relate to that, you're able, I think, to poignantly identify with the rest of our culture. This is the way our culture is. The aspirations of something, of greatness, of accomplishing something that means something, that is purposeful, has more or less fallen out of our culture's calculation of life. Most of the people that we're interacting with are just trying to get by from day to day, numbing ourselves with the distractions of our wealth, the distractions of entertainment, things like that, and so that we never really get at the important questions of life, because those important questions of life defy an answer. So many of the people that I have interacted with over these many years really intelligent people, super accomplished people, when it comes down to the really important questions of life that we must all face, like what happens after that last beat of my heart? All of a sudden, these highly educated, very skilled people just turn off and say, I don't know. I don't think about stuff like that. Well, why don't you think of stuff like that? Isn't that, if you knew what the end was, doesn't that sort of define the meaning of everything from now till then? Look, if we've got whatever years we have, then that's the end, and you've become fertilizer for the grass or whatever. Then doesn't that suggest that whatever you're doing in your life now is just utterly purposeless? That there will come a day not very long after you're gone where no one will remember your name. No one will care about anything that you've done. Of course it's like that. We have to have answers to these basic questions of why do I exist? What happens when I die? Is there a God who loves me? Is there a God to whom I am accountable? What does it mean to live in God's world? And what are the implications of knowing God in my relationships with the people around me? Those are the questions, my friends, that define our life. And it just is the case that we live in a culture of hopelessness. There are no answers to those questions. And so we've just lived, we've opted for fear, a fear that we cannot answer those questions. And so therefore a collapse into a hopelessness where we just are so cynical that there would even be an answer, that the very thought that someone would express it is an embarrassment to us. And that's exactly where Eliab is. He's so defensive with David. He goes right after his motive. But the heart of faith is very different. The heart of faith says something questioning. That's what David does. He's questioning. Really? Here's a question for you. You look at your situation in life, you wonder, as friends of mine have, I spent this week in pretty detailed conversations with a couple in our home church whose child turned one yesterday. This is a child that was born with spinal muscular atrophy. It's a death sentence. Most children don't even live to see their first birthday. This child was put on an experimental program, which is shocking and stunning in the sense that it has actually rewired his DNA. This is a child who's going to live potentially a completely normal life. But here's the thing. They went through a process of what does this say about God? What does this say about our future? When they learned this week that it's well within the likelihood that their child will never walk, what do we do with that? And it was just so interesting to walk with this couple through that circumstance and to put on the table all the accusations that came towards them. God isn't fair. God doesn't love my child. This situation will never get better. And then they begin to think, well, but what is the basis of this doubt? Why do I feel this way? And this is exactly what the psalmist calls us to in Psalm 42 and 43. Why are you in despair, O my soul? We have to ask the question that is behind the question. What is it in me that takes the experiences that I face, the very real fears that exist, and turn them into an indictment against God? Is it not because of my belief that I deserve better? That I should not have to live in the broken world that was created by everyone else around me? And then we examine that and we realize, you know what? The problem in the world is the same problem as with me. I'm as broken as anyone I know. I love the way Paul puts it to Timothy in talking about his own inner world and the sense of privilege that he had to live for Christ. He says, I am the foremost of all sinners. And that is an important place to be because it enables us to recognize the truth of the fact that anything that good that comes to us is purely a gift from a generous God. Never ask God, what do I deserve? That the answer to that question is not a good thing. We don't live on a deserve system. We live in a broken world where God graciously gives to us despite our unworthiness and despite the fact that we don't deserve anything coming from Him. And if we are prepared to examine our doubts, to examine our fears, and to say, what is this fear that I'm facing? What is this doubt that I'm encountering? What does it say about me? About my demands and my expectations and my perceived sense of rights and the way things I always thought that things should go for me and they're not going that way. What do those things really mean? And so here's an opportunity. Through the fears that we all face and the pain that these things raise in our life, to begin to doubt our doubts and to really drill down and say, what is the thing that is driving this anxiety that I face? This anger that I just don't ever seem to have mastery over and that just pops up in ways that often I can't even predict. What is at the base of this hopeless feeling that I have that I'm screwed and nothing's ever going to get better? That I'm just this way and there's no changing. Is it not a set of demands that we place upon God? That He should absolutely be doing things on our terms, that God should live in my world and not me living in God's world. And so David is just bringing to his brother's consciousness through asking this question, hey man, why are you revolting in hopelessness in this situation when there is a God of the armies of Israel? We move on to Saul. Here's a very interesting interaction. In verse 32, David says to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight the Philistines. Okay. Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine. You are just a youth while he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb, I went after him and attacked him and rescued the sheep. I've killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And so David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. So Saul says, go, and may the Lord be with you. You're all full of piss and vinegar. Have at it. Fascinating. What is Saul? Saul's a practical atheist. That's what he is. He's not a confessing atheist. He believes that there's a God. But he's a practical atheist in the sense that his belief that there is a God makes no difference in the calculation of the circumstances that he faces. Now, think about that. This is pretty important, actually. He says, you are not able. Well, is that a true statement or not? Hard to say. But the assumption is that what is true of past failures or the gravity of the challenges that we face are the things that determine the outcome. Saul is just being reasonable. He's 6'6". He's 250. He's wearing 120 pounds of armor. He's got a javelin that weighs 30 pounds. The tip alone will pierce your body from the front and will exit the back. He has armor that is so heavy, there's nothing that you could throw at him that would not do anything other than just bounce off. Dude, you are so screwed. Oh, we've seen this before in battle, what it looks like. Indiana Jones to show up with a sword for a gun battle, right? And so it is just obvious that whatever this little twerp is bringing to the table is insufficient for the nature of the threat that he faces. You're not able. Your genes are against you. The circumstances do not favor you. You will fail. But go ahead. Don't let me try to talk you into it. And so that's the practical atheism that he is describing here. Here's my question to you. In what sense can it be said you are a practical atheist? What in your life is that challenge of faith, that risk that God is calling you to address the fears that are controlling your life? And you're saying no. You're saying, I don't have the resources. There's no way I can do what I want to do. There's no way I can deal with the problems occurring in my body, with my child, with my teenage son, with my loneliness, with all of the things that I face. There are no real solutions. I can go on and give lip service to the reality of God, but the reality deeper in my heart is that nothing changes. And if I'm honest, I'm resentful and just a little bit bitter that this is the way that it's gone for me. And if you're in that place, you understand exactly what Saul is describing, what Eliab is describing, what all the nations of all the armies of Israel are describing. That's the human dilemma. And to that, David has just really one thing to say. He's calculating from a different perspective. And he's saying that God is able. God, who delivered me from the lion and from the bear, will deliver me from this Philistine as well. He is able. I don't need to bring weapons of his warfare. I'm good enough with what I've got. Here's the thing. Memory is a funny thing. Saul's memory is every time someone who's weaker goes against the stronger, they lose. Okay? That's a memory. That's true, too, most of the time. David has a different memory. His memory is that when I was at risk before through bears and lions going after the sheep, I was able to fend them off, that God was with me, that I had the resources that were given to me by God, and I was able to have mastery over that circumstance, and God is good. Memory is a funny thing. Memory is driven by the heart. The things that you remember and how you remember them apply to your present situation, but they are shaped and molded by the condition of your heart. We all have evidence moving in two directions within us, both of which are actually true. One is that, no, I don't have the resources. I am not able. And the other memory that we really need to think about is how generous God has been despite our failings, our weaknesses, our complete unworthiness. And God has been there and God has stepped in and God has accomplished something sweet within us. See, both of those things are true, are they not? Anyone here this morning who knows Jesus Christ knows that that's true, that God pursued you. It wasn't that you were so hungry to find God, that he put people in your life who showed you something different, who raised in your thinking the category of hope that things could be different, that these deep questions that I have could be answered. And we responded in faith and made that decision. And God has been faithful to us ever since. Memory is a funny thing. Your memory is a funny thing. You remember, a friend of mine I was talking to, this has been a, over a year ago now, we were talking about he and his wife had been seeking out marriage counseling, which I was happy for, and I think that more people should benefit from that than take advantage of it. He said the first exercise really was troubling. The counselor said, "Would you get out a piece of paper? I want you to put a line down the middle. On the one hand, I want you to say, here are my wife's faults. And on the other side, here are my faults." Well, he's like, just issue after issue after issue after issue. She does this, she said that, she's like that, blah, blah, blah. Then went to the other side and was like, Memory's a funny thing. His wife had the same problem. They have problems. We all have problems. Memory is so weird. It's just absolutely guided by the distorted place that our own heart is in. And David looks to the past and he says, I'll tell you the history that I think it bears on this situation. It's not the cause and effect, the big versus the small, the powerful versus the weak. It is that God has proven himself to be faithful in my life. And because he's been faithful in my life, I can trust him now, here and now, with this situation. And so here is my question to you at this stage of the game. What are you betting your life on? You're betting your life on something. You are spending your life, however many days you have left. Maybe it's weeks, maybe it's decades, whatever you've got left. You are betting your life on one agenda or another. One agenda being that this is just the way things are. Tragedies happen. Nothing explains it. This is just, I'm the subject of these forces that are beyond my control. And I just need to surrender to that. Or defy it and try to make for myself something else on my terms, my way. How's that going for you? Or we're betting our life that there is a God who loves us, who's revealed himself to us, who's moved toward our lives with mercy, with unmerited favor. See, this is the heart of the Christian message. It is not that we love God and are so worthy of his blessing. It is that we're far from God. We've each gone our own way, as the prophet Isaiah says in Isaiah chapter 53. Each one of us has gone our way to our own destruction. Look at history. Look at our own society. Look at your family. Look at your life. We're broken. But that's not the end of the story. It's the theater then in which God comes down, connects, experiences, and ultimately dies so that the penalty of our disobedience, so that the alienation that we have from God will be healed. The Christian message is simply that God loves you so much that he's died the death that you deserve so that in receiving his death for you, we can be forgiven. Any separation that exists between ourselves and God is gone. Not because we deserve it, not because we're trying so hard, not because we're vowing to be better, but because God has declared, I have dealt with the alienation that you have with me through my Son. Will you receive the forgiveness that he freely offers you? And that, bet your life on that. Please, I plead with you. Bet your life on that, the love of God in Jesus Christ. And David was such a person who made a faith calculation that God is good, that God is at work in human history, that God is at work in his life. And so in this bifurcated moment, either I stand with Israel living in fear day after day, month after month, or I trust the God who I know, and I will take this risk into uncharted territory. And that's the faith calculation that David was prepared to make, fourthly, to Goliath. The Philistine approached David with his shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, a ruddy, handsome in appearance youth. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine also said to David, "Come to me, and I will give you your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field." Then David said, "Look, you come to me with the sword and spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel." What is this? This is not a military engagement. This is a standoff between the gods of the Philistines and the God of Israel. "This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth." That. You got that? That. It's a purpose statement. Why? That all of the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and so that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into my hands. Wow. This is where the whole thing just sort of comes together. It happened then, when the Philistine rose and he came and he drew near to David, that David ran quickly toward him to the battle line. And David put his hand into his bag and he took out a stone and he slung it, and it stuck to the Philistine on the forehead and sunk into his skull, and he fell on his face to the ground. Yikes. Thus, David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and he killed him, but there was no sword in his hand. Different agenda, different game plan, different weapons, different result. Yeah? Goliath reflects a different kind of heart failure. This is of the really terminal sort. Defiant unbelief. What does Goliath come with? He comes with the curse of his gods. That's what it's all about. In the ancient world, humans were simply put there as instruments of deities to which they were bound. And so Goliath, aware of this, is basically saying, "My gods are greater than your god." And so that's what it was. And that really is why David responds the way he does. He understands that we are spiritual people living in a spiritual world in which there are spiritual dynamics and spiritual results. David does not challenge that assumption that Goliath makes. It's the first time he doesn't challenge something that someone else has said in that way. But he responds with courage. Why does David move toward Goliath? He says, so that all Israel will know that there is a God, that their God is a real God, that he is the God who is master over all of these other powers that people have worshipped, people have given their life to, that people try to grab their strength and make that the thing that works for them. Israel needs to see in real terms the victory of God over the victory over the gods that compose this age, this world. And so his courage was based not on the desire for self, but to embolden his brothers for battle, to protect Israel. But that then raises this other question: who cares about that? Is this just not one nation against another? And here, David's comment, I think, is extremely important when he makes the point that here is something that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Why? Because God has a plan for the whole earth. Why does God call Israel? He tells Abraham in Genesis 12, verse 3, so that through you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's why I bless my people, not as an end unto itself, but so that they can be a blessing to the world. That's why I do it. Because I have an agenda not just to create some ethnic people to show that I'm a God that's greater than all others, but because I love all of humanity. And so I want to demonstrate my reality through my people, a testimony to the nations. And so David sees correctly this situation, this threat of the Philistines and of Goliath in particular, for what it truly is, which is that it's not just some army raising up against another. I mean, that is the whole history of the human race. But he sees this in the particular moment of the God of Israel revealing himself, manifesting himself, making himself known to the challenges that his own people face, and as a witness to the world that is looking on and is saying, there's something happening down there in Israel that we've not seen before. This little nation of 12 tribes is able to have victory over the greatest power on earth, the Egyptians, and the greatest power of their day, the Philistines. Not because they had the greater tools of warfare, but because they had the living God. Why is it so important that you respond to your fears in faith? It's not merely so that you can begin to be shaped and molded by the life of faith and begin to experience authentically and deeply the good things that God has for you. That is important, but that's not the end game. The end game is so that everyone who looks on can draw the conclusion about who is God. What does God have for me? It is living hope with a living testimony. That's why God does it. We are blessed so that we can be a blessing. Now, let's just bring it all together here. I want to say a couple things. What David describes, what we hear, see in the narrative of David is a courageous heart, which is that he is able to assess his circumstances and the real fears that he faces from God's perspective. That he is willing to take action based upon that calculation that God is in the mix. He's not a practical atheist. What is it? If we say we believe and we disconnect that from a relevant set of action steps, that really does raise the question, do I really believe it to begin with? And nothing really establishes the reality of our faith more than taking that step, risking, putting ourselves out. Faith is risk. And then ultimately results, that effective demonstration of the presence of God's reality and of his power. These are the things that we see David as his first act as king of Israel, demonstrating that heart. And so I just put to you some food for thought. Are you prepared to speak to your fears rather than listening to them? Are you just passively taking in all the things that are threatening to you and just allowing them to define the rules of your life? What act of courage is God calling on you to today?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.